This is the oral history for the National Council of Jewish Women, and we're going to start now. Alan, in August of 1958, you went to the then USSR. You were there for a month. Could you give us sort of a sketch of how things, what it was like there, and...
Okay. It was during the Cold War. The treatment Jimmy Rand, Bart Iberl, and I, who were part of the group, were to get was absolute freedom to see anything we wished in the USSR. The U.S. Embassy, looking at our visas, said they'd never seen one that permitted that much, you know, anything we wanted to do. It meant absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Elaborate on that, please.
Well, you wanted to go somewhere. You can't go there. So whatever they had said, there was for show only. But, you know, there was one thing we did that I'll never forget. We had gone to from Moscow to Leningrad once by train and wanted to return by plane. So they didn't have any seats. So we said, we'll stand by. Well, they don't know from standby. But we said, you know, we had our interpreter with us who knew how to deal with Russians by cursing and all that. And they let us on the plane. I've never seen a plane. We got seats. I've never seen a plane where people were standing. Like on a subway with straps. We were received with caution by the big wheels when we were at Moscow when we first arrived. I had given them a list of what I wanted to see, and they had said, that's not possible. We've got to schedule various places to give a talk at each of the places.
What was their agenda, and what was your agenda? I think that's sort of
well,
the direction.
Well, I know what our agenda was. It was to follow up on the agreement between Eisenhower and Khrushchev that we would go there and see what they had that might be of interest to the United States that might lead eventually to the granting of most favored nation status as far as credit is concerned. There, presumably, they had the same objective, to try to treat us so nicely and show us things that it would be, it would lead to that. But the bureaucrats, it's a big jump from dealing with a minister, this minister who had come to the United States that I met, to the next level, who are the real rough, the technocrats who are protecting, whatever they wanted to protect. And when they said no, I said, I mentioned that, I think, last session. I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give one talk at the end of my talk. The title will be Information Retrieval and Machine Translation, Comparison of U.S. and USSR Methods. And they said, no, that's not possible. So I said, fine. And I reached into my pocket, took out my tickets, and said, I want a limousine now to the hotel to pick up my stuff and take me to the airport. I'm returning right now. Well, it worked. Bit by bit, I got to see every one on my list except one.
Which was what?
This was the Laboratory of Electric Modeling. And they claimed he was the director, whose name I'd known from his publications, was frankly the most interesting to me. And he was said to be on a business trip, he was sick, you know, all those sorts of things that they normally say. So to jump ahead, 6 months later, I went back alone, took a cab from the hotel after I checked in, and gave me the address. I found out what the address was of his laboratory, and the driver said, you can't go there. I went, go. He threw up his hands, and he takes me there. And I went to a place where they had a ring, a barbed wire, so it was obviously a secure place. Had I told you the story?
No, but I'd like to go back to the original visit first,
okay,
if you don't mind.
Okay, so I went to, maybe 15 to 20 places, I forget how many. There are centers for computing, there are centers for machine translation, center for this, that, the other thing, all the different units there. Center for Processing Literature, which was a very extensive one. And at these places, they knew my name since I had published a lot. So I was received very, very well. We talked about the means of cooperation.
So this was more of your peer group, is that what you're saying?
Peer group, that's
okay.
Right. And, everything was great, let's do it, and all that. And none of the things worked out. They agreed to do things that didn't work out. As I was going through this month, it began to occur to me that there was enough going on there that it would be interesting to have an international conference back in the States with them and other countries attending. So without getting anyone's permission, I started inviting them to this conference, which eventually got pulled off in Cleveland, where I was at the time. And they agreed. I picked the ones who were to give papers. And by the way, there were four of them who were supposed to give papers. They all agreed to do it, all sent their papers. None of them were permitted to come. Four others came instead with other papers to read. Which is normal, it was normal for that time.
And how different were the papers and information? And
well, what is the difference between day and night? That was the difference.
That was the difference. Because you were able to read the papers that preceded the four that you originally thought were coming.
Yes.
And then the other four came. Did they send you their material ahead of time,
too?
They just came. Okay, what I wanted to ask you is, was Ross with you in that first month?
No.
And was...
By the way, can I follow that a little bit?
Certainly.
She was not with me that first month. She was not with me the second week, 6 months later. But it led to her saying, I'm coming with you the next time you go. And I said, but you've got to have an official position. She said, I'll be your interpreter.
That you mentioned.
I told you that.
Yes.
But she didn't know Russian, so she went ahead and learned.
Marvelous. How fluent did she become?
She taught Russian at Pitt for 5 years.
Great. But she also told you, had you counting from 1 to 10, and you ended up on the 11th floor. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, now I wanted to ask you, had a friend or someone that you knew, George Bookbinder.
Yeah.
He
was a friend of Jimmy Rand, buddy of his.
And was he there when you were in Russia?
The first time, but not the second.
He was. And
the first time, he was the one who would get on the phone to set up appointments.
Okay.
And he would yell in Russian, he would use rough language, and he's the one that did it.
Okay, and why and how was he born in Russia?
Well, why was he born? Because his parents were there. He was born by normal delivery. I'm sorry.
I deserve that. His parents lived there? Were they American citizens?
Oh, no. These were
So he was a native Russian?
Native Russian Jew.
Born in Russia?
Born in Russia. At the age of 14, I guess. I forget for the moment how he came across, with his family or not. I just don't remember that story.
Okay. All right. That was...
But suddenly World War II started. He got in the army. Became a first lieutenant and was parachuted down as the liaison between the advancing U.S. and Russian troops. This is the only one who was fluent in Russian and fluent in English.
But
so he learned his army language by those contacts.
Okay, but he was in the USA Army?
USA Army.
After he moved there when he was 14. Okay. Became an American citizen. Okay. Do you have any contact with him now?
No. After a few years, it just dissolved.
Yeah.
He was a New Yorker.
Gabby, do you have anything more you want to ask about Russia? Okay, then Harper's Magazine. You mentioned to us this morning that there was an article that...
After the trips, after just how it happened, that John Fisher, the then editor, of Harper's contacted me, that I was the first one professionally who had gone to the USSR, you know, the Cold War, and wondered if I'd write a piece for them, which I did. He sent it back, said, "That's an excellent article, excellent, for an obscure scientific magazine." And he told me what he would like it to be. So I rewrote it, sent it back. He said, "A little better, but anyway." I did it a third time. Then we got on the phone and chatted. He says, "Look, I'm going to send Mozart to Kathleen Myers, who's the associate editor. I'm going to send to spend a couple of days with you in Cleveland," which he did. And this article emerged. It was hard for me to recognize the article, but it was, it's a good one. I mean, now it matched the Harper's
style.
I never worked so hard for any publication, ever, but it was very nice.
It was worthwhile, I guess.
So here's the Harper's issue, which I'm not going to give you.
We'll copy it.
But it's here.
Great.
No, I've got a reprint of it here.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Wonderful. I'd like to hear a little bit more about Chancellor Litchfield, please.
Chancellor Litchfield was the most exciting person professionally that I have ever met. There had been a determination for several years to set up at Pitt an activity, a development in the information sciences. I am told he was the one that decided that was the a development that needed an academic program, and that we'd be in a good position to do something about it. So they scouted around, a lot of people scouted around, and my name came up by a number of people in Pitt and other places. And they said, "Don't bother, he's married to Western Reserve, Cleveland, he'll never leave." And I ran into a professor, head of a department, at a conference in somewhere on the West Coast, who later became an excellent friend of mine. And we started chatting, we were on the same program, and he told me about all this. And actually, I was getting a little bored at Western Reserve, time for a move, I thought. And I said, "No, don't give up. Why write?" And I didn't think more of it. I had thought enough of moving that I had already made arrangements to go elsewhere. I had given verbal agreement that I would go, but I held back for some reason in sending the official letter of acceptance of their offer. And I had promised this given weekend.
And who was that for, may I ask?
They didn't want the name because of the way it worked out.
Okay,
they
all right.
It. I was to send my response in that given weekend. Saturday morning, I get a call from someone I had known in Washington who was now at Pitt, and he said, "I understand you." They had gotten word from this other place that I was moving because there were a lot of grants I was getting from one of the agencies that he had been connected with, and they told him, "Hey, did you know Kent is leaving?" So he called and said, "I heard you're leaving Western Reserve. We want you." So I said, "Well," I told him the situation. He said, "Well, look, I'll be over in about 3 hours, pick you up and take you in." And 8 o'clock on Monday, and I held back sending the letter. 8 o'clock on Monday, they started a round of interviews where I met every vice chancellor, every dean, anyone. They had it all arranged for breakfast, brunches, lunches, all that. By 5 o'clock, I guess they had decided that this is what they wanted. They then ushered me into Litchfield's office. So we sat alone and chatted, and he says, "I want you to join us." And we talked about it, and it was exciting. This was a very exciting man. His ideas were just out of this world, better than I'd ever heard before. And I said, "Fine." He said, okay, great. What'll we name the baby? So he, I said, I haven't thought about it. I just agreed to do it. He said, let's call the instrument the Knowledge Availability Systems Center. And with a simple charter, develop for PIT a program of research, operations, and teaching in the information sciences. I said, okay, it's a pretentious name, and my buddies out in the field will snicker, but what the hell, I'll live with it. After our discussion, when can you start? Well, we agreed it would be that September. This was in March. Waiting outside was one of the vice chancellors, and he came in to take me to dinner. He went in privately to see Litchfield, to see how it came out first, then came out. As we were walking along, he said, you know, I don't know what kind of a person you are. I have never encountered anyone who would agree to come without asking what the salary would be. I said it would be a competitive salary, and that's fine. So worked out more than competitive without having to ask for it. So,
has that style worked for you all along?
Yeah, I never had to ask for a salary.
And you've never been disappointed, or?
I mean, the only time I was disappointed was the one year when Pitt almost lost its shirt and was about to go bankrupt. And I got a letter saying that no one is going to hand you raises because we don't have it to give. He said, but I'm almost ashamed to tell you, we'll give you $200 to tell you we love you. So obviously you couldn't be disappointed about that. But aside from that.
What year was that the Pitt was bankrupt?
You remember Kurtzman became chancellor.
I wasn't here.
Pardon?
When?
You weren't here.
When who?
David Kurtzman, you remember the name?
No. But this was long into, that was sort of the beginning of Litchfield's downfall, wasn't it?
Well, this was after Litchfield's downfall, and there was an interim.
So how much after?
A few years.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway,
In all the years of your association with Litchfield, did you continue to feel the way you did?
Oh, yeah.
He stuck with his...
Oh, yeah. Our families got to know one another. We used to go over to his ranch up in Potato City, as we called it, outside of Cottersport.
Which is what, here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, north.
Yeah,
north. You keep going past... it's north. Past Oil City and all that. Anyway,
he was blamed for a lot of the University of Pittsburgh's problems. Yeah. And how did you feel about that?
Well, I think I knew the inside story.
And how did it differ to what we as the general?
The inside story was that Alan Scaife was the one who had given the orders to Litchfield, changed this into a number one institution in the country, research and teaching. I'll cover whatever it costs. And he went and did it. And then Alan Scaife died.
And the estate didn't?
I didn't.
Honor?
Yeah. And
so you feel he was completely innocent? He didn't have any grandiose ideas?
He had grandiose ideas.
But you felt that...
But that's what they wanted him to have.
Okay.
And I remember there was... what was his name? Willem Price, who was... chairman of the board of Westinghouse and also chairman of the board of Pitt. Got to know him quite well over the years when he was chairman of the board and following when he used to come to functions as a former chairman of the board. And that almost every one of them, when he met me, he'd call me over. He had a couple of drinks each time and said, Alan, I couldn't help it. I was ordered to do it by the Mellons to fire him. I couldn't help it.
So even that?
Even that. He had to keep saying that.
Yes, and then Litchfield had such a tragic ending. Would you like to, just for tape?
About that, yeah.
About his accident?
I was going to the airport this Saturday morning, I guess it was.
Do you know what year?
I don't remember.
Okay.
The year was. I had organized a conference that was meeting at the airport, and I went there, and told me, yeah, I heard the news, the plane had gone on the train. Our two young kids who knew their young kids had never encountered a situation where their, some of their age had died. And it was a tough weekend.
How old were the Litchfield children? I don't remember.
Let's see. Now I have to remember what year this was, but they were almost identical to our two youngest children. About that time, I guess, 6 and 7, 7 and 8, something like that. It was his second family. His first wife had died. This was his second family.
Hubert Humphrey. You mentioned Hubert Humphrey. Could you give
us... Well, let me just finish that. Two weeks after that episode, the kids had gotten over it, got a package pressed, as it had been mailed from Columbia, South Carolina, South America, where they had been, with gifts for everybody, and opened it up again. Well, we were very close.
Were you able to keep the stuff?
Pardon?
Were you able to keep the things? And
oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it must have been very difficult.
Yeah,
I've had that experience. Hubert Humphrey.
Hubert Humphrey. That headline that I showed you in the plane dealer came out as a result of the a leak by one of our that led to all this. If you have a major U.S. newspaper for a major city like Cleveland, have a front page story like that, it gets picked up by the wire services, and it hit Washington as well as many other places. And
I don't want to interrupt you. That we have on your,
yeah, okay.
What I'd like to know is.
But that led to my. A call from you.
Right. Yeah. What I wanted to know, and I don't want to be rude or interrupting you, but since this is a follow-up question, I just want to know what you're, as a person, did you get to know him? I just wanted
to... Got to know him, not socially, but professionally, on several occasions, before, during, and immediately after hearings that he conducted, that I was a part of. He was a vital, ebullient, highly intelligent person. I mean, just an interesting guy. And it was great. When he was running for the presidency, wrote him a letter and asked him if he ever wants any speeches to be drafted in the areas I'm involved. He did, and I sent one.
And did he use it?
I don't know if he ever used it. I mean, that could be a lot of speeches.
But he did respond to you.
Oh, yeah. And once he came in to visit Pittsburgh, and a party had met him, including the chancellor, not Litchfield, it was after Litchfield. And he said, "Where's my friend Alan Kent?"
How nice.
Yeah. And he had that kind of memory, and I guess good file, good support. That he knew in every city who to who to mention.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Good, great politician. Interesting guy.
You mentioned Project Love.
Yeah.
First of all, I didn't quite get the date of that when you went over to London.
July 1945.
Okay. And we know what the project is. You explained that to us. Are there any other details that you'd like to give us surrounding or your life?
Is my career would have been entirely different if I'd accepted the offer to stay in the service or take the civil service job with that project, because that has continued through a number of successive organizations.
Such as?
Well, it was a project at that time. That was called the Air Documents Research Office. Then it became the Central Air Documents Office, not just with that, but adding a lot of other material, Then it added more and more until finally it's called the Defense Documentation Center. And it's a massive organization. I'm glad I didn't stay, because the people I know very well who have run these agencies live a horrible life in government. They're doing well financially, but a horrible life.
Meaning they travel and
uprooted? The red tape that they have to worry about, all that.
You mentioned in your last tape that you decided you were going to leave the service. I realized the war was over, but how do you yourself decide that you're going to leave the service? Or were you at the point where you had a career?
I was at the point.
Okay. Where you had a choice of becoming career or?
Yeah.
So you had that choice?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This was, and you know, the general, this was the massive demobilization period, and they were trying to save as much money to, you know, you didn't need that many millions of people in the service, and everyone got demobilized, everyone had a chance at it. But, you know, an individual group could say to you, gee, we'd like you to stay. That's the way it was.
Okay. But
nothing more exciting than that.
And what happened to Perry?
Perry, what did I say about him? Do you remember? I mean, where was I?
Do you have the notes, Gabby?
Well, tell me if I'm repeating. You may remember. He and I went to Columbus, Ohio, Patel Memorial Institute, and to Western Reserve.
Right.
And you stayed and he left.
Well, at some point.
I stayed, he left.
Right.
He left to go to Arizona State University well before I went to the University of Pittsburgh. Arizona State University, he took with him one of our employees, a woman, married with four children, converted Catholic. He was a converted Catholic. And they both divorced their wives and got married. And being a younger woman, I guess it was too much for him because he died of a heart attack at the age of 64.
Oh, my. So. Okay, you talked about being tenured, quote, unquote, at a tender age. What age was that?
Yeah, that was thirty-seven, which was at that time a fairly young age.
That was still Western Reserve.
At Western Reserve.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Hillel, I'd like to know a little bit about how active Hillel was at City College in New York, and whether
I didn't know there was a Hillel. I didn't know from nothing. This was a
okay.
Yeah.
And Blacks, was there a? Are you aware of? Andrew's sisters. Did you ever get a chance to say hello to them, or did they just sing and greet you, or?
Oh no, they were in the little boat alongside Queen Mary.
But you never got to see them,
No.
I was just curious.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'd like to mention. I know you were involved with Saccharin and your financially unsuccessful venture. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about Saccharin, or do you think it would be an important thing
it's
for us to know?
It's not a very sweet story. You know, it was something one does when one is young and inexperienced, and it was a good business lesson for me not to have my head turned by people who didn't know business either. They were two attorneys who invested too little to get something, and I didn't even realize you had to investigate. Can you get the raw materials? Can you do that?
And how do you feel about Saccharin? Do you think that do you feel there's been so much controversy between?
I have no feelings about
it.
At that time, there was nothing known about it.
Okay.
Or at least I didn't know about it.
And then detergent, that was such a...
Oh, surface active agents at that time was just the beginning of detergents. I have no comments about that.
Okay, all right. You mentioned that Roz had tremendous influence on your cultural development and your involvement with formal religion. Would you like to?
Yeah. She was brought up with a great deal of influence of her grandparents, who lived, when she was a kid, very close to where her folks lived. And she spent a great deal of time there. And they were religious people. She was brought up in that environment. So that has remained after a hiatus, after we got married. We didn't have religion for a while, but then very soon afterwards, we began, when we settled in, we began to, in Columbus, Ohio, at Patoma Wireless 2. That's when we started to get involved with religious matters. Then when we went to Cleveland, there we joined a conservative temple, and then continued. She's the one that tries to drag me to Friday night services, not always successfully.
Has this been sort of a compromising relationship, or have you actually, since you had so little form of religion as a child, aside from your bar mitzvah, has it changed your attitude, or is it just a coexistence with a mate that you...
Coexistence, and, you know, I'm not a tough guy. Well, you better ask her. If she really wants to go to a service, I'll go.